This is the second day of this January 2019 Rohatsu 7-day session. Yesterday I read from the short autobiographical accounts of a couple of Chinese masters from roughly the Middle Ages and their Enlightenment accounts in order to remind you all what is possible, what is within reach of all of you, even in this week. I'm going to leave that behind now and turn to a portion of Basui's teaching that usually don't get to when we read from it. Every once in a while, I read this from this book, Mud and Water, a collection of talks by the Zen master Basui. And usually I don't get to this page 80, and so I'll tackle this now. We haven't maybe ever read from. Basui was born in 1327. He's one of the most illustrious of the Japanese Zen masters. I think many of us know him primarily from his talks, his Dharma talks that is included in the Three Pillars of Zen. This title, Mud and Water, a collection of talks by Zen Master Basui, translated by Arthur Braverman. Mud and Water refers to near the end of his life, where his disciples said they wanted to publish a collection of his talks, as he himself hadn't really written anything for publication. And then they asked him what title to give it, and he said, well, it's such a crude collection, why don't you call it Mud and Water? That's just from memory. Let me give it more attention here. The term mud and water, in Japanese it's wade gasui, has meanings other than just rustic works. He said he didn't know what title to give words put together in such a coarse fashion, like what mud and water mixed together. But it also, it can be understood as an allusion to the bodhisattva ideal, in which the enlightened bodhisattva treads the muddy waters of the world to save ordinary people. In a koan in the Blue Cliff record, it describes the clear-eyed person as trudging through mud and water, mixing with people. Anyway, this is in the form of a dialogue, this part three in the book, where the questioner begins, how do you distinguish right views from mistaken views? Basui, whether the perception is right or mistaken will be determined by the heart of the practitioner and not in words or statements. How can it be determined if you do not meet the person directly? Now, this is a basic premise of Zen teaching, is it's not in the words. It's not in the words. It's the understanding or lack of understanding behind the words. We could say the spirit behind the words. That's what a koan work is all about, is trying to discern the understanding of the master or the monk from just the words on the page, which is always somewhat less than perfect way of interpreting. Better always is to meet the person directly. Basui reminds us. And then Basui continues, before Basso had penetrated enlightenment, Basso is the Japanese name of Mazu, who is reported to have had 139 enlightened disciples. Before, let's call him Mazu, had penetrated enlightenment, he lived in the mountains practicing sitting meditation for long periods, never lying down. The Zen master Ejo went there and started polishing a tile in front of Mazu's retreat, saying he was going to make it into a mirror. This famous story also appears in the Three Pillars. He laughed at Mazu for sitting in quiet meditation with the intention of becoming a Buddha, while not understanding what he, Ejo, was pointing out by his action. As a result of Ejo's laughter, Mazu was immediately enlightened. Had Ejo not gone there and showed this to him, Mazu would have kept sitting in quiet meditation, passing his time in vain. Yes, another basic understanding in Zen is that they're sitting and they're sitting. There's sitting where we're just sifting through thoughts in the mind, just having assumed a certain posture, straight back, cross-legged posture, but we're not really doing the work. We're just allowing the mind to rove in a kind of aimless way. Whereas real concentration is something else. But the even more basic point of this story of the polishing of the mirror is that it's not that we need to become a Buddha. We already, all of us, are endowed with this luminous, enlightened nature, and that one can become attached to sitting. And yet, for centuries, Zen practitioners have gathered periodically to sit in what we now call sesshin. There's much one can. There's a lot of advancement through sitting, especially many hours a day. But there's always the danger of getting attached to sitting, as there is the danger of getting attached to anything. Anything can become an attachment. Even the best things can become attachments. Basui continues, from ancient times up to the present, no one who has gone to live alone in the mountains before having attained enlightenment has ever passed on the wisdom of the Buddhas and patriarchs. Though 10 million people may gather together, if the source is not deep, the river will not flow for long. That is why all those who aspire to the way discard mothers, fathers, teachers, and elders. I think teacher, he means here, academic teacher. Do not consider 1,000 ri a long distance. Let's make it miles. I'm not sure what the conversion is. Doesn't matter. Do not consider 1,000 miles a long distance. Are not concerned about hunger or cold, and seek out good teachers. When they come into contact with the teacher, some realize enlightenment after a time, establish a mutual rapport, and leave after receiving verification of their attainment. others, after a word from the master, begin to understand the import of his message. There are others who, after believing, even to a small degree, put down their walking staffs and place their aspirations right there. Some work tirelessly supervising the running of the monastery. Others eat the fruit of trees and wear grass robes. And others eat one meal a day while their lives hang from thin threads. Feeling no shame, though they are ridiculed and admonished, concentrating on the important matter of life and death, these people let their deluded minds wither, forget their own egos, take no pride in their understanding or attainment, practice rigorously to the point of forgetting the flavor of food, and travel on pilgrimages, forgetting they are walking. He's talking about a real model of Zen practice. They do not collect sayings or phrases of the ancient masters. Usually that means koans. They're not just gathering koans like chestnuts. Their true desire is only to meet a teacher. Since their sole intention is the complete understanding of the great matter, they do not limit themselves to 30 or 40 years. Though their hair turns white and their teeth turn yellow, they do not become idle. When they penetrate directly to the source, even after they receive verification from a good teacher, they do not get caught in their own glory or superiority. Some may leave, retiring deep in the mountains, burying their names in a ravine, eating boiled wild roots, nourishing their spirits, not pursuing fame. Others may stay near their teachers and serve them, never seeking the ultimate quiet of sitting idly by themselves. I've never heard of anyone who, making this kind of true religious practice his prime objective, did not penetrate the truth. They all promoted this vital wisdom of the Buddhas and patriarchs. Though they lived in peace and quiet, they could not refrain from appearing in society as a light of direction on a dark road, planting seeds of wisdom in the 10,000 worlds. Aren't these people in fact true transmitters of Buddha's grace? Yeah, there's a lot to admire about such practitioners. Just to pick up a few of these things, not pursuing fame, not indulging in just sitting idly by oneself when there are so many beings who are suffering, who could benefit from the Dharma. Burying their names in a ravine, having no desire for fame. Take no pride in their understanding or attainment. This is itself a sign of real attainment. There's this wonderful phrase, I think Zen Master Yunmen or Umon uttered. He said, having some attainment is the jackal's yelp. Having no attainment is the lion's roar. Of course, what he means here is he's not clinging to any idea of having attained something on the part of the lion's roar, as compared to carrying around one's idea of whatever insight one has had. And those, he says, who put down their walking staffs and place their aspirations right there. There's a certain form of avoidance in which one can just make the circuit, even in Basui's time, of just traveling around, going from one temple, one teacher to another. It can be a way of dodging the real work. And now, by way of contrast, he starts on a series of types of practitioners who we don't want to emulate. He says, how incredible. Today's students of the way are of inferior character and their aspiration is superficial. They give no thought to the truth of the great matter of life and death. Though they go to teachers everywhere, they don't want to penetrate completely all the way to the bottom. They only care about their relation to the teacher and his name, not knowing whether he is a teacher of the right law or a heretic. They count names, journey to the east, west, north, and south, and take pride in having met many teachers. Some may, for example, place their faith in one locality, spending a summer in a training session there. During this summer period, however, they just spend their time preparing for their pilgrimage following that training period. I have to confess to regretfully having done some of that on a pilgrimage I took to Japan in 1985. I regret having spent as much time as I did plotting which place I would go to next, which country, and organizing the logistics and all. I did this because I didn't plan anything beyond the first place that I went, a temple called Bukokuji, Tangen Roshi's temple in Japan. I've always been a non-closure person, meaning just rather adapt and go where the wind blows me, and so I didn't want to have to be bound by a whole itinerary stretching over many months, which I don't regret. That has its value of being open to adapting to what you find in any particular place, but I spent too much time on logistics for the next place I was going to be going to. Some may consider a place to do a combination summer and winter session, counting the days, and hence making 90 days pass slowly. Counting the days, and hence making 90 days pass slowly. This would also be a way to have sesshin pass slowly, is to be focused on what time it is, what day it is in the sesshin. Big mistake. We have the possibility of going beyond time in sesshin more than any other place. And of course, we do that through absolute absorption in the practice we're working on. That's when time disappears. That is an experience of eternity. No time, no place, no other place, no time, just this, fully, completely, have to find a way in Sesshin to leave time behind. And we all have that. It's in the practice we're working on. He goes on, others may keep a pouch containing a handwritten chart of the lineage of a Buddhist tradition, wearing it around their necks as proof of their attainment. Or they may hold on to sacred relics, putting the related implements in order, secretly forming groups of 3 to 5 people, constructing pagodas to put the relics in. They then view these relics together, expressing their strong desire for the most rare and precious among them, and discoursing on the superiority and inferiority of them. These next few pages give us a little window into the diversity of practices in the Buddhist world, and many of them, we have to say, are not something that are advisable, to say the least. Some burn their bodies, arms, or fingers, severely inflicting pain upon themselves, and getting those who trained at the same retreat all worked up, engaging them in useless activities as they themselves neglect their religious practice. This burning the fingers or arms was a practice that you read about from China, and not even so ancient China. It was something that came, even was part of in the 20th century China, Chinese Buddhism, where the monks, as a sign of their, it's bizarre. Apparently, they felt that if they burned their fingers or this or that, then this would prove their commitment to the Dharma. It's hard to imagine that Shakyamuni would approve of such a thing after he himself went through his period of asceticism, 6 years of severely ascetic practices, and then rejected that path. There is this practice of taking vows, burning little tiny cones of incense on the scalp. I saw some monks on my pilgrimage who had the scars in their shaved heads from doing that. And there, at least, there's a little practical purpose behind it. When you're in pain, you're going to do anything with greater fullness of attention and commitment. And that was the idea. If they would take their, say, in some it would be monastic vows, if they took those vows, hands palm to palm, with these little cones of incense burning on their scalps, then it would go deeper. The vows would go deeper. Because when you're in pain like that, we read that yesterday with the Chinese master who was besieged by mosquitoes. When you're in pain, the only way through it is to be fully concentrated, focused on what you're doing, and not having the mind divided by thoughts. Others embrace the gathering of followers, become attached to their lay names, artistic skills, and family names. Still others cannot completely rid themselves of the path of duty. As a result, they lose sight of attentive practice, hold on to their own thoughts and opinions, and indifferently assess the Buddha Dharma. This is not clear to me what he's really talking about. They can't rid themselves of the path of duty and hold on to their thoughts and opinions and indifferently assess the Buddha Dharma. We'll just move on. Though they try to surpass others with Zen stories and defeat them in question, answer, combat, They don't have the power of seeing into their own nature and therefore collect paradoxical words and clever expressions from old masters and keep them in secret, showing them to no one. Using these words and expressions, they write poems and songs and take pleasure in adding their own critical comments to the words of the masters. Through the clever use of words, they try to defeat their fellow practitioners. These are all examples of the way of heretics. The words, "This is not the Dharma," doing these things. I'm hoping that these pages can, by making clear the wrong ways that are out there, that make more clear the way, the right way, the Dharma. It's a good part of the job of a teacher in advising a student is to point out how the student might be going astray or might go astray. It's not so much that a teacher has to explain how to practice, so much as point out what could cause problems. And then, if one does not digress in that way, then and just stay on the path, then the rest is the student can accomplish herself or himself. And then he turns his attention to other misguided practitioners. Others, when they first arouse the mind that seeks the way, keep the precepts, persevere in zazen, and perform religious practices. Okay, so far so good. When they can keep their thoughts under control for a while, they say they can clearly see their original face. Since this original face has no ego, no being, no Buddha, and no Dharma, what, they say, should be called precepts? They ignore the laws of cause and effect and treat the alms they receive as unimportant. Eating the five spicy foods, this is some designation of things that are prohibited in the monasteries, eating the five spicy foods and drinking liquor, they become wild, abuse the Buddhas and patriarchs, condemn good teachers everywhere, and criticize things of the past as well as the present. So they got off to a good start, keeping the precepts, persevering in zazen, but then went astray. This thing about mouthing there, saying, what should be called the precepts? This is a very serious disease in Zen. You see evidence of it here and there in Western Zen, as in Japanese Zen, where after some insight into the emptiness of all things, which includes morality, and seeing into the emptiness of, let's say, morality, then one makes the mistake of discarding it and saying, what use do I have for the precepts? It's all empty. This is a fatal mistake. Yes, ultimately, the precepts are empty. But that's just seeing one side of the equation. Form is emptiness. The other side is, the emptiness is form. precepts have great practical value, maintaining the precepts. But I won't go off on that tangent just now. They shout and chatter at length, joke and laugh, sport in the mountains and at sea, spend the day reciting Japanese and Chinese poems, and admire a refined atmosphere with fine flowers. See, some of these things, there's nothing wrong with them, admiring a fine atmosphere with fine flowers, but what is embedded in these words of warning from Basui is getting attached to these things. Meeting others and seeing what they possess, they desire it for themselves. Not caring about their own appearance, nor whether they are with laymen or monks, being indifferent to the occasion, they love to talk Zen and wish only to be victorious in Zen combat. When these people see others who put an end to their wrong views, realizing their deep-rooted errors, who show true concern when they receive steady alms and treat the precepts as the true dharma of thusness, who keep their mouths shut, relaxing their wild horse minds and disregarding their monkey minds as they diligently conduct their religious practice and meticulously apply themselves, sitting facing the wall in meditation, they spit, point at these people, and laugh. They say these people are dull-witted and not Zen adepts. You know, if we didn't read these such accounts in more than a few sources from the past, it might be hard to believe that there are such unsavory practitioners. But it seems that there were plenty of them. The monasteries in China, and maybe this was true in Japan as well, the monasteries in China filled up with all kinds of people who had no real spiritual aspiration. The books I've read say that sometimes they're people who just wanted to dodge paying their taxes. If they landed in a monastery, then they were absolved of that. They didn't have to pay taxes. Or criminals, even, would escape into monasteries. And then there would be parents in deep poverty who would bring their children, their young children, to be raised in the monastery to give them, to be able to nourish them and educate them. He says, they themselves are lacking in courage, their minds are full of pride. They talk of their long practice of Zen while they drag their juniors down the road of heresy. When a good teacher takes them on and tries to influence them to truly practice, they raise their fists, clap their hands, give a shout, and say, pshaw. It's a good attempt by the translator to... this old farmer's exclamation of, bah! This is part of the pose of Zen that some people take. There's a lineage in the United States where this seems to be their main demonstrations is clapping their hands, shouting, slamming their fists, striking their stick as a way of proving that they have insight. It just becomes a bit of theater that they've picked up. When a good teacher tries to grab hold of them in an attempt to discourage them, they wave their sleeves free and start to dance. They do not so much as turn their heads when they are reprimanded. They truly have an incurable disease. Medical care is of no avail. With mistaken views rooted within them, they travel around critically questioning other Zen students who are no match for them, while their arrogant pride grows. This is what is meant by the saying, to embrace the void is to disregard cause and effect. Such confusion and recklessness invite misfortune. That's the end of the quote. To beginners who have aroused the mind that seeks the way, I say, don't ever practice together with these people of mistaken views. About this attachment to emptiness, Bodhidharma, I'm trying to retrieve this from my memory here. Bodhidharma said, one who believes only that everything is empty and rejects the law of causation falls into everlasting pitch black hell. And yet it can be quite seductive for people who don't have the understanding when they hear teachers or senior practitioners who flout the precepts, have no regard for them, and claim to be beyond such discipline. Then there are others whose whole bodies shine with clarity as the reflection of the moon shines in water. But they rest content with this clearly manifested light and consider it the foundation for their inherent nature. This becomes the root of their illusions. Again, the danger of even something very, very respectable becoming an attachment. And still others ask, if all dharmas are empty, how can one practice? What teaching is there to realize? They say that when you are served tea, just drink it. And when you are served food, just eat it. They sink deeply into a shell of tranquility, and looking into the koans of the ancients, they incorporate them equally into their own view of tranquility. They reason that all these sayings are without meaning. The ultimate truth, they say, is that mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. Even in their dreams, they have yet to understand the wonder of Buddha nature. What's so diabolical about this is that someone with understanding could very well say, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, and it would be a perfect, succinct expression of Dharma because there is understanding behind it. But if you're just mouthing these catchy phrases, then it's something altogether different. This stuff has even insinuated itself into our own popular culture where people will blithely say, oh, it is what it is. Oh, good. Good for you. It is what it is. Or here's the other one I love. It's all good. All right, it's all good. He goes on. Some, not yet having seen into their inherent nature, have heard it said that Buddha nature is the master of seeing, hearing, and perceiving. Okay. When asked about it, they raise their hand, move their foot, and say, oh, here, this is what it is. Others, without any understanding, call it the way of no mind. Or they think that the physical body is like a dream, a vision, or a flower in the void. These are, by the way, the words of the Buddha. And the mind is unborn and undying, okay, always existing. Or they understand both body and mind to be illusions, which, after they dissolve into the four elements, return to the void and disappear. This is all straight up truth. Or they consider enlightenment to be the state when one no longer doubts that all form is emptiness, which in the final analysis is the substance of the Dharma body. Or they feel that verbal expressions, no matter how few, are all mistaken. They say they will withhold their true experience of enlightenment from even their closest friend. They acquaint themselves with the occult, playing around with spirits. remember this is the 13th century, they say that even the clear-eyed do not see what they themselves can see. Then they lower their heads and whistle to themselves. There are others whose minds remain calm and composed as they eliminate all thoughts. They follow the path of no mind, their minds perfectly clear and cheerful. Still others revel in form to the extreme. They love manner and decorum far beyond the behavior of others and follow the way of morals and ethics. Or, not having the mind that seeks the way, others become interested in fame. They desire proof of their attainment from a good teacher, and if they don't receive it, they scornfully denounce the teacher. Or, believing in the law of cause and effect in all situations, some feel that even their failure to realize the Buddha way is a result of past karma. This is one of these traps that people sometimes fall into they don't come to realization, they fall back and say, well, it's just because of my karma. I must have a lot of bad karma, which is just another dodge way of absolving oneself of responsibility. This reference here to reveling in form to the extreme, form meaning etiquette, the proper way of conducting oneself to minute detail. This is another danger that we see out there in Zen, modern and contemporary Zen, both in Japan and here, where the substance gets completely eclipsed by the attention to form. They say they do not have the karmic connection with the way and will not become enlightened in this lifetime while trying to exhaust all bad karma of previous lives by performing various practices of self-abandonment. They make pilgrimages to shrines and temples to gain spiritual merit, recite diverse incantations, count prayer beads, and make hundreds of prostrations praying for the mind that seeks the way. These people in particular are of extremely low aptitude. All these people fear life and death. They are sick in the mind, a sickness which occurs when one seeks the way while not yet having developed correct views. Bad as they are, however, they don't compare with those who have no fear of life and death and do not seek the way. So having fear of death can be a great asset in practice, a great spur, a blessing, really. Remember my first year of practice, my abiding fear that came to me at all different times was that I might die before coming to awakening. It's a great, great spur. Then there are the rebels. Calling themselves liberated, they throw away their three types of robes and their begging bowls. They don't wear monk's robes. They put on courtly hats, wear skins of dogs, cats, rabbits, and deer. They sing and dance and criticize the right law. They pass through this world deceiving laymen and laywomen. We are so lucky. I have to say this. We are so fortunate. Not just at this center, and there are other centers also where this kind of thing would be unheard of. We really, you know, it's fashionable for the masters throughout history to say this was the Dharma, theirs was the Dharma ending age. And yet look at the positive side of there's a lot of sincerity. And certainly here, everyone who comes here knows that they're never going to get away with this kind of stuff, that they come here to practice out of sincerity, earnestness. We're very fortunate to have so many others, like-minded others, who will fortify us in our efforts this week. Well, we'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind meshes. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind meshes. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind meshes. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.